He was an 18th century Superman, a one-man army who took center stage in some of the pivotal battles for American independence. Though Daniel Morgan is little known today, he was the field commander every general wanted on his front line.
He was physically strong, he was inspiring, he was charismatic.
In the Northern Campaign, Morgan led an elite regiment of sharpshooting riflemen that helped turn back a British invasion from Canada. And in the South, Morgan executed the most brilliant battle plan of the war.
It was the tactical masterpiece of the Revolutionary War.
Daniel Morgan, rough and ready maverick of the American Revolution, next on Washington's Generals. December 31st, 1775, 3:45 a.m. Nearly four detachments of American soldiers are positioned outside the walls of Quebec, Britain's last stronghold in Canada. Fewer than 2,000 redcoats and Canadian militiamen are spread through Quebec, not nearly enough to defend such a large walled city. The American attack plan is calculated to exploit this weakness. Two small units will stage decoy attacks or feints on Upper Town, the northern part of Quebec. These actions are intended to draw defenders from Lower Town, where two American columns will converge in full force and penetrate the city. General Richard Montgomery and Colonel Benedict Arnold command the main detachments. The attack itself has been ordered by General George Washington to prevent a British invasion from the north. At 4 a.m., a cannon burst signals the attack. All four columns advance.
And everything worked out. The feints went off. The attack started on time. The Canadian defenders moved to where, away from where Arnold and Montgomery was going on. But then things started unraveling. The plan started unraveling.
Arnold leads his men towards the first of two barricades that block the way into Quebec. The British open fire. A musket ball shatters Arnold's leg. His battle is over. The column, however, must continue. To move forward, it needs a new commanding officer. All eyes turn towards one man. He is tall and muscular. Is Captain Daniel Morgan.
Morgan is described by many contemporaries as the coolest man under fire one would ever see. He calmly gave orders. He calmly assessed the situation. It was impossible to get him excited except going after the enemy.
There was also an air of mystery surrounding Daniel Morgan. He spoke little about his early life.
He was born in poverty in New Jersey. At the age of 17 or 18, left home forever, got in apparently in a terrible argument with his father and left home, never talked about what it was, never returned. We know nothing about that youth up to that age, nothing at all.
Morgan headed west and settled in the rough and tumble frontier town of Winchester, Virginia.
In his youth, he'd been a brawler, boozer and a wincher, and he was a diamond in the rough, is what he was.
Add to it the fact that he'd been a veteran of a couple of wars, including the French and Indian War, made him quite a character.
Tough, smart, and proven in battle. At Quebec, Morgan was the consensus choice to take Arnold's place.
Morgan, at the behest of the other officers, took over, even though some of these officers were senior to him, majors and colonels. He was only a captain.
In the heat of the moment, Morgan's command wasn't formalized by an order from Arnold. At the time, it didn't seem to matter. All the officers followed Morgan in attacking the first barricade.
The Americans had scaling ladders, put them up against the wall. Morgan ordered the men forward, but they hesitated, and so, as Morgan always did, he led by example.
He mounts the ladder, he gets to the top, there's this huge explosion. Muskets are firing at him point blank. They miss him, but that exploding powder throws him back off the ladder. He lands on his back in the snow. His face is scorched. Bullets have just narrowly missed his head.
Nobody else volunteers to go up that ladder, including the other officers. Morgan leaps to his feet, goes up the ladder again, jumps over on the other side, lands on the end of a cannon, which hurt him considerably. But saved his life because he fell under the cannon and the British couldn't get at him with their bayonets.
As the Redcoats stab at Morgan, his men swarm over the barrier into Lower Town. The British abandon their position. Morgan drags himself from under the cannon and sees the fleeing soldiers enter a house.
Morgan ran to the back himself, ordered all of them to surrender, telling them they were completely surrounded and they would take no quarter unless they laid down their arms. He captured an entire house full of British troops.
After turning the prisoners over to his men, Daniel Morgan and an interpreter went ahead to scout. Morgan discovered that the remaining barricade had been abandoned. Moments later, he found himself at the threshold of Upper Town, the objective of the entire operation.
Morgan wanted to push ahead into the Upper Town, and the other officers said, no, we're at the point where we're supposed to meet Montgomery. We have to stay here.
Morgan yielded to the consensus. He delayed the advance and waited for Montgomery's column. He had no idea Montgomery had been hit by enemy fire during the opening minutes of the attack.
Montgomery never came. He was dead.
And the man who relieved him simply turned his 300-man column around and retreated without letting anyone else know what he was doing.
Precious time passed. Morgan waited. No one came.
Morgan then met again with the officers, and they finally decided to continue the attack, even without Montgomery, towards the second barricade. But their fate was pretty close to being sealed.
By daybreak, the British had regrouped. They were now defending the second barrier in full force. Morgan and his men advanced into a hail of musket fire.
Found himself now in house-to-house fighting. This is urban warfare. And urban warfare really hasn't changed much over the years. The weapons today are much deadlier, but you're still fighting somebody house-to-house, eyeball-to-eyeball, basically.
The fighting was savage and futile. Redcoats poured through the side streets and surrounded the Americans. All but Morgan surrendered.
Morgan himself, he's like a caged beast. His men are begging him to throw down his arms, and he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to give up his sword.
He continued to plead with his men, begging with his men in tears to continue the fight. He was finally backed by a British force up against the wall, where he continued to hold his sword in his hand. He turned toward a completely surprised Catholic priest who was in the crowd, handed his sword to him, and swore he would never give it to one of the British.
Morgan would spend more than 8 months as a prisoner of war. His release would come just in time. A British army was advancing out of Canada, intent on crushing the rebellion. And Daniel Morgan would play a critical role in the effort to stop them. The young Daniel Morgan was a rough and tumble frontiersman. He drank, gambled, and broke the law. At various times, he was arrested for arson, horse theft, and assault. At the Battle of Quebec, Daniel Morgan's courage and take-charge attitude had impressed everyone, even the enemy. While Morgan was their prisoner, the British tried in vain to buy his allegiance. When Morgan was ultimately released, General George Washington himself lobbied Congress to award him a higher rank. No sooner was Morgan promoted to colonel than General Washington selected him to command an elite regiment of 500 hand-picked frontiersmen.
These would be Continentals, but they would be riflemen, trained backwoodsmen who did not wear a regular uniform, who are hunting shirts, who carried tomahawks, who are experts in living in the woods just like Native Americans.
It was the rifle, however, that would become their most famous trademark. Unlike a musket, which was accurate only at close range, the rifle could send a deadly shot across an entire landscape.
The great thing about the rifle was its accuracy. An expert rifleman could easily hit a man at 200 yards.
Normally, a musket has to be aimed at the broadside of a barn. A rifle can be aimed at a person's head.
Officially, Colonel Morgan's unit was the 11th Regiment of Virginia, but the men were known as Morgan's Rangers or Morgan's Riflemen. Their role as snipers would become legendary under the command of Daniel Morgan.
Morgan's not your typical Continental officer. He's not a high-toned, well-educated gentleman. But he's reliable, he's brave, he's resourceful, and men will follow where he leads, including some of the wilder and harder to discipline elements that come to the Continental Army from the frontier. Morgan is the right man to lead those kinds of troops. He understands them, and they respect him.
Morgan's Rangers didn't have long to wait for a call to action. General John Burgoyne and his army of nearly 10,000 Redcoats, Loyalists, and Indians had crushed one American outpost after another since rolling out of Canada in June of 1777.
The Americans were under a real threat of having the colonies bisected by a major invasion coming down Lake Champlain, Lake George, and the Hudson River. The British hoped to cut off troublesome New England from the rest of the colonies, and therefore, by breaking it into smaller parts, could take care of each one individually.
Washington sent Morgan's Rangers to serve with General Horatio Gates, whose Northern Army was the last remaining obstacle in front of General Burgoyne. Gates and his ranking officer, Major General Benedict Arnold, built fortifications south of Saratoga, New York, on a commanding promontory called Bemis Heights. The stage was set for a climactic showdown. On September 13th, Burgoyne ordered his army to move towards the American defenses and send scouts ahead to probe for weak points. But first, they would have to get past Daniel Morgan.
Morgan first arrived in the Saratoga vicinity. His first job was to blind Burgoyne. He sent out his riflemen all around Burgoyne's forces, and Burgoyne's forces found they could not leave their camps, so they could not leave their lines without real hazard to their health.
You go out there and you make it difficult for them to deploy their units, to get scouts out front. You essentially do the equivalent of what they would call in Vietnam, patrol. That is, you regularly, aggressively patrol that space you cannot otherwise see to make sure that it's not filling up with your enemy.
In fact, the American position did have an Achilles heel, a weakness that Burgoyne's scouts might well have found.
The left of the American defense is overlooked by some high ground to the west. Arnold believes that if the British can mount cannon upon that high ground, then the defensive position would become untenable. So if the British do discover that weakness, then it's potentially devastating for the Americans.
Morgan's Rangers, however, prevented the British from discovering anything about the American position. General Burgoyne would have to gamble on attacking without intelligence. On September 19th, he rolled the dice. The British advance in three columns. Burgoyne's battle plan called for the left and center columns to engage the Americans, while the right column flanked their position. With the rebels distracted by a frontal assault, this third column would slowly crush them against the Hudson River. Gates believed he could repulse the attack from within his defenses, but he yielded to Arnold's suggestion that Morgan be sent ahead to trip up the British.
What Morgan is doing and moving out is basically screening the American left to prevent the British from encircling them, getting on that high ground, and forcing the Americans out of their defensive position.
1 p.m. The British emerge into a clearing close to the American position at Freeman's Farm. Unseen, Morgan's Rangers take aim. The first of that day's casualties fall to the ground. The British regroup and charge with bayonets. Because rifles are slow to load and cannot be fitted with bayonets, Morgan's Rangers must fall back. But Morgan also commands a unit of infantrymen armed with muskets, and they push forward to meet the British in bloody hand-to-hand combat. Reinforcements widen the battle. Combat rages for 5 hours. The adversaries locked in a deadly stalemate. But throughout the day, Morgan's snipers are exacting a steady and mounting toll on strategic targets.
In today's military, one of the first targets we go after is command and control. Well, that's what Morgan did with his riflemen. He told them to pick off enemy officers.
And he understood if this well-disciplined machine doesn't have its officers, doesn't have its leaders, it's going to stop.
Morgan also added British gunners to his list.
British have a very good artillery arm. And the artillery that they will have at Saratoga, both in terms of the numbers of guns, the types of guns, and the crews, are going to be far superior to the Americans. Potentially a very important weapon on the battlefield. Morgan's men will be targeting those artillery crews and negating the effect of that artillery.
Morgan's sharpshooters turned the tide. British guns were silenced. Brigades without officers floundered on the battlefield.
Things looked very precarious for Burgoyne and his forces when another force, a relieving force from Burgoyne's left, was able to come up and finally drive the Americans from the wood line and back. But the cost had been very heavy for Burgoyne.
At the end of what would be called the Battle of Freeman's Farm, the British held the field, but little else. They had taken nearly twice the casualties of the Americans, and still had not gotten so much as a glimpse of their fortifications. General Burgoyne established a new forward defense line at Freeman's Farm, where his army could prepare for a second attempt at destroying the American position. But what Burgoyne intended as a time of recuperation would become more than 2 weeks of sheer hell, courtesy of Daniel Morgan and his riflemen. In July 1776, patriots in New York pulled down a lead statue of King George on his horse. The statue was melted down and molded into 40,000 musket balls for American soldiers. In 1777, George Washington inspired little confidence as a military leader. Around the time Horatio Gates bloodied Burgoyne at Freeman's Farm, the commander-in-chief was being chased from the battlefield at Brandywine Creek by the Redcoats. Washington stood helplessly by as the British Army prepared to march into Philadelphia, the nation's capital. Hoping to avenge his humiliation with an aggressive counterattack, Washington first sought to buttress his forces with the addition of Daniel Morgan.
There's an interesting exchange in correspondence between Gates and George Washington. George Washington had sent Morgan up to assist Gates, but at some point wants him back.
This army has not been able to oppose General Howe with success and needs a reinforcement, Washington acknowledged. I therefore request that you order Colonel Morgan to join me with his corps. However, the commander-in-chief graciously left the final decision to General Gates.
And Gates basically refuses to send Morgan back, writing Washington that why would you want me to give up the element of my army which is having the greatest effect against the Indians and British.
In fact, Morgan was having a devastating effect on the enemy. Following the Battle of Freeman's Farm, The British had encamped just 1 mile from the American lines. Morgan and his riflemen routinely patrolled the wooded no man's land in between, turning it into a deadly sniper's nest. As Burgoyne's army tried to recuperate from their last battle and prepare for the next, Morgan waged a war of attrition that would slowly drain the enemy's strength and will to fight.
The role of Morgan's rifle corps is extremely important. For one, any time a foraging party goes out to try and forage for supplies, Morgan's men are there to open fire on these foragers, continue to demoralize them, prevent them from getting food.
Even soldiers within Burgoyne's entrenchments found themselves the target of Morgan's expert rifle.
It was very damaging to British morale, and especially to the men in the ranks. They couldn't relax, walk around at any time without fear of one of these riflemen picking them off.
To learn whether American snipers were on the prowl, Burgoyne's Hessian troops would raise a helmet above their entrenchments to see if it drew fire.
At one point, one of the helmets is put up and is actually shot by three different rifles simultaneously. So there's this mental quality, this erosion of morale that the riflemen are able to create by this sort of moving through the woods and sort of keeping everyone's heads down all the time.
The role in counter-reconnaissance is also very important. Any reconnaissance party that goes out and attempts to locate a weak spot also falls victim to Morgan's sharpshooters.
With his food supplies dwindling and his time running out, Burgoyne had to make a move. On October 7th, he ordered a detachment of 1,500 men to take 10 cannon and root out the American defenses.
The British still don't have a good idea of where the American fortifications are. And Burgoyne wants to figure out if he can find a way to use his artillery to make those fortifications untenable.
Alerted to the enemy approach, General Gates launched a counterattack.
Gates takes the initiative, and he looks at Morgan and he says, "Let's let Morgan begin the game." He's kind of like the elite of the Northern Army, and so you want to lead with your best foot forward, you put Morgan out in the head.
With Morgan's unit in support, Benedict Arnold leads a charge into the strength of the British line. Taking fire from three sides, the British falter. But General Simon Fraser, one of Burgoyne's finest officers, sees the collapse and rides into the fray.
He goes out and he is personally attempting to stop the panic and get his troops to continue to defend against the American attack.
General Fraser revives the Redcoats. His impact is obvious, even to Daniel Morgan across the field. According to legend, Morgan shouts, "He is a brave man, but he must die."
Morgan turned to one of his men, Timothy Murphy, and asked him if he could hit the general, and Murphy took several well-aimed shots. The third shot mortally wounded General Fraser, who was taken from the field.
Without Fraser, the Redcoats begin to disintegrate. Arnold and Morgan advance, overrunning a key fortification known as the Bremen Redoubt. The loss of this position is critical. Now Burgoyne's main encampment is vulnerable to attack, and he hastily orders a retreat. In a little over a week, Burgoyne will surrender his entire army. It was a stunning victory. General Horatio Gates soon became accustomed to hearing himself described as the hero of Saratoga.
You can argue that maybe the strategy for Saratoga, the battles of Saratoga, was Gates. But if he's the architect of victory, the contractor that built the victory was Daniel Morgan.
Burgoyne's surrender at Saratoga would have international repercussions. France was now emboldened to side openly with America against Britain.
One thing we just can't forget is that the French were as important to the United States in the Revolutionary War as we were to the French in the 20th century, in World War I and World War II.
Even with the victory at Saratoga, the outcome of America's revolution was far from certain. Indeed, the British would soon unleash a new military campaign and rack up a string of decisive victories across the southern colonies. Once again, Daniel Morgan would charge from the front lines, and this time he would lead his men in the most tactically brilliant battle of the American Revolution. How tough was Daniel Morgan? During the French and Indian War, he was ambushed by Indians. He managed to escape, despite a bullet through the mouth that knocked out several of his teeth. After the humiliation of Saratoga, Britain struck back with a vengeance, unleashing the might of their empire on America's southern colonies. Savannah, Augusta, Charleston, Camden. In one battle after another, the Redcoats ran roughshod over America's southern army. By September of 1780, Georgia and South Carolina were under British occupation. Lord Cornwallis, British commander in the South, and Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton, Cornwallis's cavalry commander, seemed fully capable of taking the British campaign into North Carolina, Virginia, and beyond. General Washington selected Nathaniel Greene to command the remnants of America's Southern Army. Greene chose Daniel Morgan as commander of his light troops, an elite unit of infantry and cavalry. Now a general, Morgan would command what became known as the Flying Army, a fast-moving detachment designed to make hit-and-run attacks on General Cornwallis. Greene would stay behind and resurrect the main Southern Army.
Greene really didn't want to bring on a battle. He wanted to harass Cornwallis and harass the British as much as possible. So his plan was to be as nimble as possible by sending an independent command under Daniel Morgan.
Nathaniel Greene had great faith in Morgan. He had enough confidence to send him with the cream of his army on his own in literally an independent command because there were something like 150 miles between them.
During the final days of December 1780, Morgan's cavalry veered close enough to catch Cornwallis' attention. The chase was on.
The British sent Tarleton's legion out on a hot pursuit after Dan Morgan, thinking that they would have no trouble driving them from the field just as they had driven every army they had met in North and South Carolina from the field.
Morgan chose a route that led through strongholds of patriotic sentiment, where militiamen joined his ranks by the hundreds. In addition, Morgan cleared the farms and fields of provisions.
As Morgan marches back to the north and Tarleton follows him, Morgan's army gets bigger every day. And Tarleton every day gets further away from Cornwallis and every day gets deeper into countryside that has already been eaten out.
By the time Tarleton's men battle the Americans, they will also be fighting hunger and fatigue, just as Morgan intended. The looming showdown would have ramifications far beyond their immediate front lines.
This is a real turning point in the American Revolution. The British so far had seen a lot of success, had captured a huge American army under Ben Lincoln, had destroyed another American army at Camden. They had a setback at King's Mountain, and now the whole balance of the war was at stake with this campaign.
On January 16th, the Flying Army arrived at a sloping, grass-covered ridge where farmers sometimes grazed their cattle. The locals knew it as the Cowpens. Morgan scouted the area. "On this ground, I will defeat the British or lay my bones," he announced. But if he didn't want to be buried at the Cowpens, Morgan would have to find a way to effectively use his militiamen, citizen soldiers who were not trained, armed, or disciplined for formal open field battle.
Morgan understands militiamen, and there's two things to understand about them. The first thing we all sort of know, militiamen are going to run away, and Morgan understands that. But the second thing is a little more subtle. they also have a very strong sense of honor. And so the trick is to find a way to allow them to satisfy their honor and run away.
Morgan devised a plan that would allow them to do both. He will deploy two successive lines of militia and a line of Continentals with cavalry in reserve. As the British advance, the first line will shoot twice, then withdraw and merge with the second line. The second line will also fire twice, then withdraw behind the Continentals to act as a reserve. The Continentals stay and fight.
Knowing that the militia will probably retreat, but also knowing that they're capable of inflicting large numbers of casualties on the British, some of them with rifles and aimed fire, he takes the fact that they will retreat into account.
And so what Morgan comes up with is this idea that he will ask them to fire twice, and then on plan, as part of the plan, then leave, then run.
In devising his tactics, Morgan had also considered the likely reactions of the British cavalry commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton.
Morgan probably expects that when Tarleton sees the militia leaving the battlefield, he will be convinced that victory is at hand. But in this case, this is a controlled retreat, and Morgan is in effect luring Tarleton in to yet another area where he can inflict additional casualties upon the British.
Even the terrain becomes a weapon in General Morgan's remarkable battle plan. Morgan will position his first line at the crest of a small rise. To reach them, the British will be running uphill, draining their strength with every step. Recent research suggests that Morgan deliberately staged his second line on the downward slope of the rise.
Most soldiers with muskets tended to fire high, and they tended to fire high even more so when they were firing downhill. And Morgan, we think, understood the British would be firing higher than normal, and he hoped that that would reduce his casualties.
There was one other factor that would make a difference on the battlefield: Morgan's deep rapport with his men.
The night before the battle, Morgan walked the campfires and spoke to almost every single soldier individually, making sure from the highest officer to the lowliest private they knew what to do, asking them just to do their part. We know you boys don't have bayonets. We know you can't stand up against Tarleton's legion. Just give me two shots, then you're free to go back. That's all I ask of you. You do it for old Dan.
Then he tells them, if you succeed, boys, when you get home, the old folks will bless you, and your sweethearts will kiss you, and you'll be the heroes of the day.
He really won these guys over, and they're ready to do anything for him by that next morning.
Daniel Morgan eventually abandoned his wild ways, with the exception of an affair that produced his only son. After the war, he became a successful land speculator, joined the Presbyterian Church, and doted on his 19 grandchildren. It was one thing for Daniel Morgan's men to sit around a campfire talking war. Quite another to face battle-hardened British soldiers primed for the kill. It remained to be seen if the militiamen would keep to the plan while under fire. Morgan woke his men shortly before dawn. Bannister Tarleton and more than 1,000 soldiers were rapidly approaching the cow pens. It was time for the flying army to put General Morgan's battle plan to the test. At 7 a.m. on January 17th, Tarleton led a charge toward the American lines. As Morgan later recalled, the British raised a prodigious yell, came running at us as if they intended to eat us up. The militiamen in Morgan's front line waited until Tarleton's legion came into range.
It The riflemen started knocking down, especially the officers, immediately. They fired a couple of rounds, and they fell back on cue. In the second line, the same thing happened again.
The Americans, of course, knew the retreat was planned. But to Tarleton's men, it looked like the militiamen were running scared.
They were convinced one more push and they would have them all. They didn't realize that the Americans had been planning this and rehearsing this in their minds for 24 hours.
Sensing victory, Tarleton's men press forward and meet with a blast from Morgan's third line. Bodies fall. The British return fire. The Continentals hold their position, reload, and shoot. Neither side gives ground.
And at a certain point during this slugfest between the British regulars and the Continentals, there appears to be a moment when the American army is going to be outflanked on their right.
The threat comes from Tarleton's Reserve Infantry Regiment. The Continental commander, Colonel John Eager Howard, orders the company on the right end of his line to turn towards the advancing British column. In the fog of war, however, the command is misunderstood.
Continentals think that it is an order to retreat, so they start to about face and start to march off the field.
And that creates a little bit of confusion, and other units see it, and they copy it, and they also start to march straight backwards.
One company after another obeys the erroneous command. One after another, they turn and march, double time, in perfect formation, heading right out of the battle. It is a catastrophe in the making.
Morgan rides up, and he says, Lieutenant Colonel John Eager Howard, are you beaten? And Howard says, do men who march like that seem beaten?
And Morgan recognizes that he's right, that this is the case, that these troops are still in command. And this retreat is actually going to do the job that it needs to do. It's going to protect the flank.
The British, however, smell victory. They break ranks and surge forward.
What they see are the backs of American soldiers. And again, in most situations, if you see the backs of an enemy soldier, you won. It's over.
As the British see these Continentals marching off the field, they believe that the battle is won. Many of them break ranks and start to pursue after the Americans so as to bayonet them.
But Morgan has instantly adjusted to the unexpected turn of events.
Morgan rode ahead, chose a spot on the field and said, boys, stop here, turn and fire a volley. As Tarleton's forces charged pell-mell without any order after the Americans, within 15 yards, the Americans stopped, spun on their heels, and fired point-blank into their faces.
At the command to fire, this sheet of flame just bursts on the American line. And then the British are shot. They come to an immediate stop. Men fall. John Eager Howard cries out, charge, bayonet. Execute a bayonet charge, British line collapsed.
The flying army wasn't done yet. Morgan had regrouped his militiamen, and now they charged the British left flank. Morgan's cavalry flanked them on the right. Tarleton's legion was crushed. Tarleton himself barely escaping with his life.
Morgan's victory at Cowpens is viewed by military historians as a classic double envelopment. It's a very difficult maneuver to achieve. It's in part due to Morgan's plan, but it's also due to his ability to deal with a changing battlefield and his soldiers' ability to react to that changing battlefield. That's why he has so much success.
It was the tactical masterpiece of the Revolutionary War. It was pulled off by this untutored son of the frontier, Daniel Morgan.
The battle had lasted less than 40 minutes. While suffering only 72 casualties, Morgan had captured 700 British soldiers and left another 100 lifeless on the field. It was a catastrophic loss for Tarleton. and ultimately, General Cornwallis.
Cornwallis lost his light troops. They were the eyes and ears of his army. And he also was in a fury over losing all those troops and determined to recapture the prisoners. He was determined to avenge Cowpens.
Daniel Morgan had anticipated such a reaction. Before the smoke cleared from the battlefield, his flying army was packed and on the road, headed to North Carolina. Not only did Morgan have a head start, his force was faster moving. Cornwallis came up with a radical plan for speeding up his army.
He burned his wagons and supply wagons and anything that would slow him down, personally taking his own baggage and throwing it into the fire in front of his men, saying to them, now we're going to get them and travel the same way they do.
Cowpens had left Cornwallis short of soldiers. Now his provisions were depleted as well. It was a desperate gamble. Cornwallis drove his army relentlessly, but Morgan, later joined by Greene, stayed just out of reach. Still exhausted and short on supplies, the British fought Nathaniel Greene to a stalemate in a major battle at Guilford Courthouse, North Carolina, on March 15th. Soon after, Cornwallis withdrew to the coast, then marched to Virginia. He set up camp at a place called Yorktown, where he would ultimately surrender his army. Daniel Morgan, however, would miss this final act of the revolution. Immediately after his race against Cornwallis, Morgan had taken a medical leave of absence. He had been through too many years of combat, grinding winters, night marches, and all the other extremes of military life.
All those things took a tremendous toll on even this guy, who's a very healthy, robust guy. And in the end, after Cowpens, he's going to have to retire.
From his home in Winchester, Virginia, Morgan wrote a letter to Washington at the front lines in Yorktown.
It's a really touching letter, partly in the sense that you're sympathetic when you read it to what Morgan's going through. Morgan's sick, he's in pain, he really wants to be part of the big show at the end. But also, he puts forth that he really wishes he could have served with Washington at least once.
I have never, on any important event, had the honor of serving under Your Excellency, Morgan reflected. Nothing on earth would have given me more pleasure than to have made this campaign, to have shared the danger, and let me add, the glory, too. For Daniel Morgan, the revolution was effectively over. During subsequent years, his health did improve, and in 1794, he actually served as a general during the Whiskey Rebellion. Morgan also spent a few undistinguished years in Congress.
He wasn't a legislator by temperament. His sole contribution in Congress was seems to have been to call the Jeffersonian Republicans a parcel of egg-sucking dogs.
First and foremost, Daniel Morgan will be remembered for his steadfast patriotism and his remarkable capabilities as a military leader. His textbook victory at Cowpens is still the subject of study and admiration.
I've been in the Army for 20 years, and I learned from an ROTC book, and I still can see that picture in my head, the sketch of Cowpens with the lines of militia, the Continental, and the two envelopments going on and going, that's what a battle's supposed to be like.
You know, there's a tendency to turn a lot of these Revolutionary War figures into larger-than-life figures, but Dan Morgan certainly fits that bill. He was probably one of the best combat commanders to serve under Washington. He was physically strong, he was inspiring, he was charismatic. He could make men feel fearless when they were serving under him, and he could strike an awful lot of fear in the hearts of his enemy. I'd hate to see Daniel Morgan coming at me with a rifle in his hands or with a tomahawk brandished over his head.
Daniel Morgan was a fighter until the end. During his final days, Morgan was heard to say, "If I could be 21 years of age, I would be willing to be stripped stark naked on top of the Allegheny Mountain to run for my life with a pack of dogs at my heels." General Daniel Morgan died shortly after, on July 6th, 1802. He was 66 years old.